Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm here with my co-hosts Laura Chen Baker and Bianca Bremham.
Hey.
Hello.
Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action, in between the client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. Every week, we come together in the mobile crime lab that is our recording studio and dissect three different links we've come across during our recent internet travels. We use these as a jumping off point to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we're going through our open tabs and we'll be discussing Basecamp's library rules in open office spaces, what $50 gets you in motion design commissions, and the future of podcasting. Helping us bring some additional perspective to this week's episode is a managing agent and producer for our North American office, Bianca Bremham. Some more astute listeners might have noticed a distinct lack of Bremham in this season, and that's because we've been deliberately changing things up a bit here, as there's simply been too many good links to share each week, and it's really hard to shut us up. So, to help keep things at a more reasonable level, we're capping it to three links, and we'll be regrouping / catching up with B every couple of weeks. Welcome back, Bianca. How is life going in your jam band commune?
I've missed you guys. Clearly, you're doing fine without me, but alas, it does feel good to be back on the mic.
It's facade, Bianca. We miss you deeply.
Yeah, whatever. Can you believe we are 50 episodes in? I'm excited.
I know.
We have some fantastic guests coming up on the season. The real cross-section of creative types from all corners of the industry and the globe. So I'm excited for you guys to interview them over the coming weeks. It has been a crazy couple of weeks here in New York. I think since we last sat down to record, it's summer, it's bloody hot. And I guess in between navigating the utter madness that is the New York real estate market and spending a week in Detroit to hang out with the American illustration community at the Icon 10 Illustration Conference, we have been tasked with some insanely quick turnaround animation projects over the last week or so. They do not call it the city that never sleeps for nothing. The cliche is 100% true. How are you guys?
What's the Melbourne cliche? What are we? The city that what?
The Garden State?
Well, no more the most livable city in the world. We were eclipsed by Vienna this week. So we are a city devoid of identity.
Ever since you moved here, Jeremy.
Exactly. Thank you. Well, you are, Laura, in Sydney. What is Sydney's claim to fame? Warmer.
It's
warmer than Melbourne. Great.
It's warmer. The men are blonder. That's about it. But I'm enjoying it. Sydney's good. Everyone's happier because it's sunnier. And I think Melbourne, people get bitter around this time of year, myself very much included.
Yeah, I think it's like for our international listeners, especially our American listeners, Sydney is definitely the LA of Australia.
Yeah, I mean, except without all of the cool stuff that LA has. I think like we're having a good time though. I'm here with Clara. We're running a bunch of our Open Tabs events, which has been awesome. You can find out more at opentabs.rodeo if you're interested. And we'll be here until Friday. So that's glorious. Jeremy, how are you going?
I'm here all on my lonesome, and it's really weird because, yeah, this is the first time we've all been in three separate places. So I'm very excited. Lots of exciting things happening as always. And I think we'll just get straight into our links for the week and changing things up. I am going to get things started
first. Kick us off, Jeremy Wartzman.
And this is a link. I will kick us off. And my link this week is from Signal versus Noise, which is the Basecamp blog that is hosted on Medium. We had a bit of a chuckle about Basecamp on where we were talking to Andrew two episodes ago about how Basecamp, I guess, interacts with their customers and, you know, how they have very kind of strong kind of feelings about work and about offices. And this particular article is called Library Rules, How to Make an Open Office Plan Work. And they are really interesting in terms of how they talk about and deal with kind of the physical office space in a creative environment. I think one of the things Basecamp is most known for is their being very transparent with a lot of their policies in terms of, you know, how they employ people and deal with managing people, especially through remote work. So it's interesting when they set up this new space that they have in Chicago, I was following it very keenly. And I really enjoyed when they documented the process of how and why they made the decisions that they did. And that was a few years ago. I'll find the link and I'll post that to their original office overview. And that really inspired me why I kind of wanted to document our space as well. And it really helped me figure out things, you know, when we were designing our office here and how to kind of consider these two different things. But the most interesting thing that Basecamp does, I really like with their writing, is they come up with really interesting analogies for certain things that you might not kind of think of. The analogy here is they're looking at library rules. And what they say here is, walk into any library in the world and you'll notice a few things. They're generally open spaces with a number of desks and services scattered throughout, similar to an open floor plan office. And two, they're quiet. And then they say libraries are full of people working, reading, thinking, studying, writing, contemplating, designing, etc. Yet they're silent. People are heads down doing independent work. In our opinion, this is the model business, the model office. We pattern our way of working around library rules. And I thought this was so interesting because I don't think this would have worked, or this kind of analogy would have worked before kind of the rise of huge open plan offices and co-working spaces and things like that. And it's weird. Like, once you kind of have this vision of the library in your head, it's like, oh my God, this is like a kind of just like a big co-working space. But like with everything that Basecamp writes, like I find it also always kind of so interesting, but then always kind of so unachievable to kind of put into our own perspective, because I guess what they're working with here is a very kind of, they're developing products, they're talking to kind of customers. It seems like a very independent, solitary kind of task, where the work that we do at Jackie Winter is so much more collaborative, where we kind of need to have this kind of what I call kind of the big brain. When a phone call comes in, Everyone kind of needs to know kind of what's happening, or if someone's talking to an artist or a client, like everyone kind of has something to kind of contribute. And I think that they talk about digital distractions in the same way. And so they say library rules means keeping to yourself, keeping your voice down, etc. And then eliminating distractions doesn't mean physical distractions. It increasingly means virtual distractions. And they say real-time chat rooms / channels are basically open offices, and worse in many ways. And so, yeah, like I have a lot of kind of feelings about this. And I thought it'd be really great to kind of hear your opinions and take on this piece, because we had two very different ways of working in Melbourne and New York. I'm just kind of curious, Laura, are there any takeaways from this piece that you think less solitary business pursuits like ours could learn from at all?
Yes. I mean, I've got to be the only person in the world who like doesn't actually hate the open plan office. Just firstly, like it's nuts. I think every single office I go to is open plan, and then every single article on the internet is about how bad open plan is. So what the hell? Anyway.
Well, I think it's interesting because like you wouldn't be alone in kind of loving open plan offices. Like the argument that's put forward is that like, well, it's always the higher ups and the bosses who like open plan offices because, well, they're more flexible, like they're cheaper to kind of fit out all these kind of other things.
Why am I not one of the higher ups or the bosses, Jeremy? No, but like, I mean, for me, I do my best work when I can see other people sort of being motivated and working hard around me. And I do get some of my best deep work done at home these days. I think like I had to work really hard to stop like using being by myself as an excuse to get distracted. So for me, being in an office, particularly an open plan office, is actually really beneficial. But the thing as well here, I kind of feel like the library analogy falls down a bit in like, of course they're not talking to each other. They don't fucking know each other. Like that's completely different. It's a completely different social situation.
I know, I was thinking the same thing. Like, I love the concept of library rules, but honestly, I can only really see it working like in an actual library where, yeah, like a public library is filled with random strangers who are all working on completely different things. You know, in an office, you've got a team of people who, while working individually, working together. And in the majority of cases, I mean, I share an office with another business, but they're working for the same company or they're working for the same manager.
That's a really good point, because it's like, well, this kind of also seems to me, and again, like I think I've been in places like the New York Times newsroom, for example, and like other large ad agencies, and those are huge open plan offices of like, you know, hundreds of people like in one space. I haven't had that experience personally to work in them, but I completely agree. Like this is also a potential downside of remote work. Like Basecamp says that in this whole kind of office, there might only be kind of five people there on like a given day because everyone else kind of is remote. And I wonder like, well, these people are spread all over the world. They haven't kind of met each other. Is that kind of good for kind of fostering culture? And like maybe library rules.
Yeah. And one of the few places these days that we still get, you know, as adults, that we can get like a sense of, I guess, community and belonging, whatever, is actually in the workplace. You know, like we sort of do less like team sports or sort of connect with people via social media. There's, you know, like we are sort of distanced from each other more and more. And then you even get down to things like sort of housing, because of prices, people have to move further out and they see people less, blah, blah, blah. So it's like being in the office is one of the times that you actually get to be connected to a team of people. And I think that's like not to be sneezed at. But at the same time, like, of course, there's a difference between like being connected and having a healthy office space and a great environment to work in and a space that's just like too distracting for you to get anything productive done.
Definitely.
But like the article is interesting. I think like we already do take a lot of the advice, and like many of the things that they mention here are things that we ourselves took like very much into account when building our current office. So like things like having separate like spaces for people to go and work in solitude if they need to, having rooms that people can take long calls in, having a dedicated like large meeting area, etc. So, oh, the other thing I loved about this piece is when they talked about the acoustic design of the office. And I think that's something that a lot of people might neglect. They talk about the materials that they use to minimize noise travel and echo, and they went super far with this. It's worth going and checking out the article and seeing how they did this, because it's really cool. And I think the other thing probably makes the biggest difference is something they've done here, and also something we've utilized in our own space as well, was ensuring that whilst the office plan is open, there's still some sense of divide between desks. Like firstly, they are actually separate desks, like one to each person. And also like when you're looking at your screen, you can't directly like see or make eye contact with another person. You have to actively sort of move to go get someone's attention or talk to them. And that helps sort of minimize those interactions that could be disruptive, I guess.
Yeah, I love looking at other people's offices. There's a site that I read that we'll link to as well called Office Snapshots. And like, it's amazing just to see how different people kind of, you know, set up their spaces. And what Basecamp did with acoustics was amazing. And I do think it's also kind of, there's a technical problem to be solved as well, because sometimes I find that it's like, because we're all on laptops and all on mobiles. And like my whole kind of idea was, well, if everyone was completely mobile, then we could kind of, you know, detach from kind of the mothership, like, you know, at any kind of time and go to kind of a different space if we need to. But I kind of feel like even with laptops though, like, you know, we're tethered, we're to the monitor, you know, window sizes change to the monitor, or, you know, you have other stuff plugged in, you have other kind of notes that you're kind of writing. Being able to be kind of like fully mobile is really kind of hard. And I kind of think, well, the more that we kind of evolve the tech in the way where we can really kind of be untethered. And I think where I've been working a lot on the iPad, I spoke about this last season, but I think the more we can move towards that truly untethered environment, that will make perhaps these like little nooks more kind of usable.
No, I love the idea of having my space at work. Like that to me, again, just makes it start to feel
like your anchor.
Yeah, but also just feels like this impersonal sort of co-working space again. Like for me, it's important to have a spot where I've got like, I don't know, like a vase from home, or like just the shit that I need, like a pen.
Something that's going to trigger you into like, this is work. Like I'm doing work right now. Like there's like a psychological, I think there's something nice and like psychological about sitting down in your space and doing your work.
And it just feels as well that they've carved out a space for you, you know, like that the people you work for are thinking about you and have this space for you that's dedicated for you. That to me is important.
It was so funny. I was in Wieden and Kennedy the other day and I was waiting in the lobby, and it was just a cliche of an advertising agency. There was like, in I think the 5 minutes that I was waiting for our client, there was just person after person, like in like a cool outfit, holding a laptop, walking somewhere. Yeah. I just couldn't believe it.
I want to hear a bit more about your experience in New York, because we share a space with a more traditional design studio, which I know from my own experience has a definite different approach, a lot more kind of solitary, like more kind of how Basecamp kind of describes. How do you find a balance between the work that kind of we need to do, which is more collaborative, vocal, et cetera, and, you know, being in a space with a different kind of a studio?
Well, I want to preface this by saying that I absolutely agree that an open plan working environment should, for the most part, be heads down and relatively quiet. But the thought for me of working in an open plan office in absolute silence sounds bloody awful and gives me so much anxiety.
It's creepy, right?
I mean, I'm a highly sensitive person, so I do find that I do my best work and I work best when there's a bit of music or like some kind of background noise there to help cut through any tension in the environment. And this is not to say that I want to completely ignore any tension or bad energy. If it's there, it needs to be dealt with. But sometimes some kind of gentle flow through a space, whether that's the right kind of music or some general gentle background noise, can really help shift the energy in an environment, or more often than not, my own mood or energy from bad to better. So I think like complete silence, terrifying, maybe great for some people, not for me. But to give our listeners a bit of context, here in New York, we do share an office space in Manhattan with a small design studio, 0.5 Design. Jackie Winter headquarters in Melbourne, however, is a much bigger operation with the agency. I think, what are we now in Melbourne? 12, at least 12 full-time? Yeah. 12 or more full-time employees taking over every floor of a three-story building. And I would describe Jackie Winter HQ in Melbourne as predominantly a production office. There is a constant stream of phone conversations, in-person conversations, Slack conversations, fires burning, excitement, despair, brainstorming, problem solving, dogs barking. It is an incredibly active space. It's also a public space. The bottom floor of the office is a gallery where, you know, visitors can come in and visit, like they can walk in off the street and activate the space in that way. And that can be very overwhelming when you're trying to plug in and focus and get something done. But Jeremy, you touched on this, like a lot of that cross collaboration and the constant exchange of ideas, insights and information between staff members is absolutely so fundamental to our success. And so trying to balance that kind of chaotic playfulness as our role as creative producers, matchmakers, and problem solvers, which is very communicative, with the type of intense focus and concentration that tasks like writing or actual problem solving require can be very tricky. So in stark contrast, Point 5 Design, who we share an office with here in New York, they specialize mostly in editorial and publication design. There's still like general office banter and phone calls and meetings and conversation. And, you know, we do play music. But the majority of the day for some of the designers that I share a space with, or we share a space with, is spent like in the zone for, you know, hours at a time, rather than jumping frantically from task to task like we kind of do at Jackie Winter. Would you guys agree that that's kind of, I mean, Lara, you've worked a little bit at Point 5. Would you agree that that's a fair representation of the two spaces?
Completely. It's just about the kind of work that they do. And I think also just like the personalities of the people that are in the space. But everyone within the Point 5 office is so lovely and just like, and just wonderful. But I have to admit, I found being in there really strange because it felt very uncomfortable for me not to be able to like comfortably just like chat to someone. If I, you know, like in our office, if something comes up, you think of something you want to tell someone, you just do. And it felt really weird for me not to do that.
You just blurt it out.
Completely. And especially because when I was there, Arta, who was our junior producer, she was very much in training. And so I was trying to train her in a way that didn't make any noise or disrupt anyone else. And that was really weird. And so we ended up working from my Airbnb for like pretty much the whole time.
I guess like the way that like I've brought it, like the balance. So I spent a good couple of years, maybe 4 or so years, working at Jackie Winter HQ in Melbourne. So it was a complete culture shock for me to move to New York and move into such a quiet space. I went from being completely extroverted in my role to sitting on my own with headphones in and day out for, you know, a good portion of the day. And working in such solidarity though, it's definitely had like surprisingly, I think, more positive benefit than negative on my work. Negatively, I've definitely become a lot more introverted, which means it takes a lot more energy to actually get myself into a more assertive or performative mindset when perhaps conflict on a job or the need to actually present and sell comes up. But on the other hand, working in an environment that's relatively calm and quiet, which is complete contrast to Jackie Winter HQ in Melbourne, I found that drama or conflict on a project actually doesn't really come up that often. And when it does, I'm in a much more zen-like mindset to actually step back and better manage it. In the 2 years, though, that I've been here, like our office has grown and our staff have expanded. So, you know, we have a nice balance now of like free and open communication and then also plugging in heads down, the strokes or royal headache or whatever it is on repeat for an hour or two to actually get something done. But it's a nice balance and I actually kind of like it. And it's a nice refuge from the craziness that is living in New York City.
Well, yeah, Basecamp's got a whole new book coming out, which is all about being calm at work. And I think, yeah, a lot of these posts are a bit of a preface to that. But I think, yeah, like anything else that we discuss here, it's always interesting that we usually bring up the extremes in some ways. And I think, you know, Jackie Winter is a really interesting business because we don't really fit in many places. We're somewhere in the middle. So I think, look, thank you both for your insight there. And if you haven't checked out Basecamp's blog, Single Versus Noise, I definitely give that a recommend. And I think we'll move on from there.
Thank you.
Moving on to the meat in our link sandwich, our second link. Well, actually, it wouldn't be meat because you're a vegetarian, Bianca, but it would be maybe
a
soy patty or some other kind of plant-based substance. Bring us to our second link, Bianca. What do you have?
Well, my link for the week is a post titled $7 versus $1,000 motion design. Is there a difference? And it comes from a site called School of Motion, which hosts online courses, tutorials, industry news, resources, a job board, and a podcast for the motion design and animation industry. And for the record, Jeremy, I can see you like bursting at the edge of your seat. I did steal this link from you.
That's fine.
But I also asked whether it was okay if I used it, and no one responded. So, you know, you snooze, you lose. Anyway, this article can be found on the School of Motion blog, and it asks, is there a difference between a cheap and expensive motion design artist? The author, Caleb Ward, wanted to test the theory you get what you pay for and ran an experiment to see what the results would be if he commissioned motion designers at various price points to animate a logo for a fictitious company. In this case, a space-themed ice cream shop called Telescoops. And you guys touched on this in your first episode of the season with Andrew Fairclough. So Caleb sent the pitch to motion designers at three different and quite controversial price points. The first was to a motion designer he found on the very controversial online marketplace for freelance services called Fiverr, which had a price point of a measly $7. You heard that right. Seven whole dollars. You cannot even buy lunch in New York City for $7.
That's not true. I got a pretty good like $5 taco.
You can't get a great voicemail recorded for
You can. So if you are unfamiliar with Fiverr, it's an online marketplace where freelance contractors can promote their digital services, anything from writing, translation, graphic design, video editing, animation programming, with services starting at $5. The second contender in the experiment was a Fiverr competitor called Upwork, which had a slightly higher price point of $150. And the third was a professional freelance motion designer who the author found through a network referral with a price point of $1,000. So the author went through a fairly standard commissioning process, including providing a round of creative feedback, as well as changing the scope on the designer by asking for the addition of sound. It's interesting to note that when he engaged both Fiverr and the professional motion designer, the author was working with a single designer who he'd specifically chosen to do the work at the start of the process. But in the case of Upwork, he filled out a simple form on the Upwork website. The brief was posted on the Upwork platform, which made the gig available to motion designers around the world to pitch or compete for. And once the author received custom pitches from a number of different designers, he chose the designer that he wanted to move forward with. Turnaround time, the process with Fiverr took just 24 hours from brief to completion, which is kind of crazy. And that included rounds of revision and some communication back and forth. With Upwork, it took 7 days. And with the professional motion designer, the process took 6 days from brief to completion. The blog post includes a pretty good summary of the correspondence, the work in progress from each of the designers, and the finished result, as well as what the author liked and disliked about each. So we will post the link in the show notes if you want to take a look. And at the end of the process, the author also put together a blind survey and asked people what they thought about each project. So this is interesting and very controversial. And I am curious to what you both thought about this experiment and, you know, if you had a favorite, what you thought about each of the finished logo animations. Because to be honest, we consume so much content in our daily lives that when I first watched the $7 version, my initial reaction horribly was, that's fine, it does the job, I'm okay with it. And I was like, what am I thinking? And I guess like, although like the job, and I kind of say that in quotation marks, definitely positions the ice cream shop as a mom and pop shop, and that mom and pop have maybe gone out of their way to produce a cute little advertisement to screen their local drive-in cinema rather than like a piece of beautiful motion design that positions the ice cream chain as a national chain of ice cream stores. But yeah, I don't know. What do you guys both think? Do you have a favorite, and should we actually be worried?
I found this piece really like reassuring until right at the end when they had that cute little illustration. And I was like, oh, what a cute illustration. And then there's a little caption that says that they also got that on Fiverr. And then I was sad again because I liked it. But like, no, I mean, I don't think we should be worried. I think different calibers of services exist for different clients. That's fine. We don't have the same client base necessarily as people who might go on Fiverr. And yeah, I think like they all did the job to some extent. It depends on what extent you need that job to be done. I think all the things that they point out there are completely valid, in that like the final one, the most expensive one, had definitely far more like story and thought and technical capacities that are built in.
It was definitely more compelling.
Completely. But I mean, again, if that's what you need, that's awesome. You should definitely go to someone like that. If you don't need that, you literally just need a little something that moves at the end, then fine, the first option works. I mean, I have to be honest, I love the second Upwork one, the one that ended up being the final Upwork one. I actually preferred that concept by far to the others, and I just found it really visually pleasing. But yes, there were definitely technical skill differences between that and the one from the professional freelancer, which was definitely more skilled in that way. And in the end, I sort of found myself wanting to see a version of the Upwork concept, but executed by the professional freelancer. I think that would have been the best final version, in my opinion.
And Laura, I mean, I'm curious, do you think there's a threat here at all? Like to, I guess, to professional artists or to the industry in any way?
Yeah, of course. There's a threat to the industry in the sense that, like, if prices are driven down so much that people can't afford to actually be creatives full time, then you have no creatives. That's the problem with an ecosystem that's this sort of unhealthy. But I don't know, maybe I'm naive, but I do think there will still always be people sort of who have a demand and requirement for higher quality content, and the higher quality stuff can only be done at a higher rate.
I really enjoyed this piece. I mean, I have always kind of wanted to do this in some way, like especially like I kind of always thought about doing it on a larger level, like, you know, actually responding to some of the spam emails that you get about kind of redesigning your website or doing a mobile app. I mean, yeah, everybody does. But it's like I've always wondered, like, what would happen if I just said yes? And I like that they kind of followed this out. I do kind of feel that maybe there was a bit of kind of retrospective kind of justification for the higher end logo, because I completely agree. I thought the Upwork one was absolutely well done and completely serviceable,
yeah,
you know,
awesome.
for the needs. So I was kind of like a bit, it's like, ooh, what does this mean? And like, how do you kind of integrate that information? Because I think, you know, at the end of the piece, you know, all the conclusions that you would kind of come to are pretty much are kind of all there. And they say like, well, services like this aren't going anywhere. And if anything, you know, they're only kind of increasing in scope and in their kind of offering. Even services like 99 Designs, which have a lot of kind of advertising, especially like, you know, on podcasts like Tim Ferriss and everything, the way, I mean, Tim Ferriss's podcast artwork and audio is the worst. I cannot stand it, but you know, there you go. But like even a company like them, they're expanding their offerings beyond kind of the actual artist, but offering kind of project management and things like that. So I think there's definitely a threat for kind of agencies like us there. But at the same time, I have to wonder, it's like, well, the people who commission this might not kind of understand that the difference between these three options, and they're very kind of subtle. Only us, because we have kind of trained eyes, might see this. But if you're someone, this is kind of part of your business or part of the kind of the bottom line, you know, I can see how this would be very attractive. And I kind of look at any other, you know, creative discipline, like, again, go back to the kind of the architecture, you know, model. It's like, well, yes, like just because there's these off the plan kind of houses or kind of kit homes that you can kind of buy, does that mean that's going to put architects out of business? No, I don't think so. But I definitely kind of think it has an impact on kind of what our overall kind of visual sphere ends up kind of looking like, or the world we kind of live in. And it definitely pushes the bar down in some ways. I don't know if that's a really snobby thing to say, but it concerns me on that level. But I found this a bit confronting, because like it doesn't seem right or doesn't seem good, but I can't put my finger on why or like how to kind of, you know, counter things like this, or even if it's necessary.
It also makes me feel uncomfortable, because like it forces you to think about like, okay, when we're on the side of advocating for artists and for people who have spent, you know, years and years honing their crafts and whatever, and advocating for fair rates for them, rates that actually allow them to sort of exist, obviously you want to go for the professional sort of freelancer one, right? But then when you have to position yourself as the person doing the buying, like let's say we needed some little motion graphic logo thing, it's hard to tell yourself that, yeah, I would go for the most expensive option because that's the right thing to do. Would we do
that? I think it's interesting that there is kind of a scale. And despite the actual kind of finish, you know, there's a difference in kind of process. And there definitely is kind of a bit of an escalation between these kind of price points. And I think that kind of education is good. And I think if anything, if opening up the lower end of the market gives people a taste kind of for the process and, you know, allows people in some way, I think that's the first step, like in that kind of education for developing a more kind of refined palette or developing the kind of sensibilities that might want to you to kind of engage further in that way. So I do see kind of some of the benefit there. And I think, yeah, articles like this are a great way to kind of actually kind of put it into practice. I love articles like this that are kind of short, informative, but actually kind of have like something kind of real that they're showing that's kind of not a case study or anything else. Like I just really like the format. And so again, if you are listening to this on an enhanced podcast player, you'll be able to kind of, we'll put some screenshots of each of these things here so you can put into more context. But otherwise, yeah, really good piece. Thank you for all your feedback. And we will move on to our next link. And if I'm going to complete this bun analogy, which I actually didn't even start, but now I'm kind of halfway there, I've got to finish. This would be...
I think it was a sandwich, not a bun.
See, it's evolved. In the sandwich. It's the lower piece of the bread, the bottom piece, the piece that has the lettuce sitting on top of it.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Hopefully
Lara.
Not the
Thanks,
first
Jeremy.
Piece in the bag of bread, because that's the worst.
I like that piece, actually.
You calling me crust?
It depends what kind of loaf we're talking about. Anyway, we can come back to this in thumbs up, thumbs down if we want to go into bread situations. But Lara, take us through the future of podcasting with your link.
Oh, I will. So this is a bit of a long article. It begins with the sentence, "This is a long article." It's not the worst I've ever made you guys read, and it was definitely interesting. So it was published on Medium by a guy named Tom Webster. Tom is the senior vice president of Edison Research, which is basically just a market research company in the States, similar to like Roy Morgan that we have in Australia. So the article is a bit of a recap and follow-up of a keynote that he gave at the Podcast Movement Festival in Orlando last week, where he gave his definitely expert opinion of where things are currently at in the podcast medium, where they need to be, and what needs to be done in order to get there. So his company, Edison Research, release an enormous report each year on all sorts of media consumption. And I think since 2006 or something, that's included podcasts. So whilst podcasts and awareness of podcasts has been growing, you know, pretty steadily year on year, he points out that although 64% of the US population are aware of the term podcasting, you know, maybe they heard their nephew mention it or someone said it in a TV show, that doesn't mean that all of that 64% actually know what the hell a podcast is. And this is the key issue he kind of focuses on in this piece, really. That understanding of what podcasts are and how they work is still a relatively niche thing. And he sort of argues that if podcast is a medium that is going to last and also provide a sustainable format for those working within it, then we have to do a bit of a better job of explaining it to the general public. And we haven't done that yet. And I think, you know, even though everyone that you and I know has a podcast and their dog has a podcast and their dog's vet has a podcast, there are sort of millions of people out there who are blissfully unaware. And he uses the example, which I liked, that, you know, there are millions of Clinton voters who say that they don't know anyone who voted for Trump. And then there are millions of Trump voters who say the opposite. And that's because we are sort of within our own little circles. And in order to work past this issue, we need to sort of get out of our bubbles and understand the real bottlenecks to the growth of podcasting, because it actually isn't growing that fast. So, like, despite how it might feel, Tom claims that that podcasting is actually one of the slowest growing media they've ever tracked in their yearly studies, which is interesting because it definitely feels like there's been this crazy boom. And he holds up this number of 100 million weekly listeners as what the US would need to get to in order to make podcasts like a truly growing and lasting medium. And currently they're at 48 million. So there's 52 million people that they would need to capture, essentially. And this is based on his research. Whether or not you agree with that or take that with a grain of salt is up to you. But in order to reach that 100 million, the medium would have to more than double its number of weekly listeners. And at the current rate of growth, that's either quite unlikely or it's going to take a very, very, very long time. And he also raises the very valid point that whilst podcast awareness and listening is growing now, some year down the track, the stats are going to be flat or even start going down. I think, you know, someday growth simply just stops in the same way it did for Facebook and Twitter this year. And that's the crux of this article, really. It's like, how do we increase the listenership as much as possible before we hit that plateau? And I guess then how do we do that? And Tom has a few ideas. And I really do suggest that anyone interested in this actually go and read the article in full here, because I know that Jeremy's going to start playing the Oscars music over me if I keep going on. But there really are some interesting stats. And there's really interesting stats and graphs and video interviews in there. But just quick, the three main things that he raises are, one, and this is really important, is that what got us here won't necessarily get us there. You know, like what captured the current 48 million listeners won't necessarily work to get the remaining 52 million. They are a different audience and they need different reasons to care. And I think that can be said for anything where you're trying to grow awareness or audience or whatever that is, whether it's a brand or a show or whatever. It's a really valid point.
Stay ahead.
Well, yeah, that what worked to get it's not just like, oh, we need to scream this message louder. It needs to be a different message, you know? And then number two, the survey stats revealed that so many people have no idea what a podcast is or don't know how to access one or think that they cost money or think that there's just nothing out there they'd be interested in or that it's just basically the same as regular radio programming. And podcasting, I think, is confusing in a way that no other medium really is. And that provides a real barrier to entry. And he sort of, one of the things he does is he blasts this idea of asking people to subscribe to your show because this terminology is just so synonymous with things that cost money, which is a point I'd never thought about. Like anything you subscribe to in normal life is generally something that you pay for. Obviously, current podcast people, obviously, like they get that podcasts are free, but we're not talking about current listeners. We're talking exclusively about people who are not ingrained in the medium. And to them, this might not be clear at all. And also, it's kind of a big ask. Like, you don't have to subscribe to a TV show or a radio show or a movie, like almost everything else that we choose to watch or listen to. And yet podcasting requires this act of subscribing. And we kind of make that even more confusing by asking people to, you know, subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere else you get your podcasts. And this in itself is just a bit of a mess of confusion for people who aren't acquainted with the system. So he sort of argues that we need a much better on-ramp to podcasts, just like perhaps directing people to the website and keeping it simple. And then lastly, one of the trickier points he goes into is that we actually need better content to drive people to have a reason to figure out the medium, as opposed to sort of just sticking with the brilliant stuff they've already got, Netflix and Spotify, books, free-to-air telly, and you know, so on. He talks about how like lots of people didn't know what the hell Hulu was, but you give them Handmaid's Tale and they figure it the fuck out, you know? And so he says, like, you know, we need to provide something special that they don't actually get anywhere else, and then market that clearly to them, which I would argue many already do, but you need to read his full point for context, really. Anyway, how do you guys feel about this?
Is it selfish to say that it's kind of nice that podcasting isn't totally like, it hasn't totally infiltrated the mainstream?
Yes, I was going to go there.
I think that there could be like so much more interesting things happening in the space, but...
I was going to say, like, I agree there, and that my concern was that if it does go like fully, fully mainstream and there are opportunities to actually properly make money and, you know, then that sort of drowns out the little guys. Like at the moment, because I mean, you can make some money, but it's not as viable as, you know, a big network show or whatever, you know, it means that there's kind of space for everyone. Whereas if it does become this huge money-making thing, then you only get all the big players instead of a huge array of small players, which is what I like about podcasting.
I see all the points you're making there. And again, sometimes I always feel like I'm playing devil's advocate with these links, but I don't know, maybe that's my job on the podcast. But I feel that this whole kind of idea on podcasts, especially being kind of content marketing or, you know, these kind of extensions of brands, et cetera, and that it's kind of always part of this kind of growth strategy or this idea that like that companies have to kind of grow infinitely. I mean, that's something that I'm kind of grappling with our own business in terms of, yeah, how do you kind of grow when demands are increasing, you know, externally, but how do you all stay small and manageable, not get overwhelmed? Again, this goes back to, if I don't want to fan out too much on Basecamp, but, you know, there are previous podcasts on before they did Rework was The Distance, all about businesses that have been in business for 10 plus years. You know, so I'm really interested in that whole idea of manageability and sustainability. And I think, you know, there was one thing here that he illustrated that, I don't know, really rubbed me the wrong way, which was explaining how, like, you know, look at the top 10 shows that people watch on TV. And it's all stuff like network TV that I would never be caught dead watching, but millions of people watch it. Like, does that mean like that those things are inherently better or that's something that we should strive for? I felt that answer is no. And that's what I like about podcasting, and that it is about this niche of finding your tribe or finding your people and having this direct line to talk to them in that way. And so, yeah, I guess the whole idea, like there was some interesting semantic stuff that he brought up and, you know, stuff like, you know, the subscribe language and a lot of stuff that I guess is technologically tied to podcasting in a way that does need to be updated. But that's the nice thing about podcasts as well, is that it is this really old technology and this old way of doing things that's finding a new voice and a new medium this way. And I think that it's going to change a lot, like in the next 10 years as well. Like, I think a big reason that I'm into podcasts, and I think a lot of people are as well, from commuting. And I think people have longer commutes now as well because they have to move further out. No, that's my case personally, but I know many other people have that experience.
Honestly, mine is standing in the line at Trader Joe's. That's when I listen to most of my podcasts, is when I'm doing my grocery shop at Trader Joe's. You don't even know.
I don't even know. But I think, look, imagine what's going to happen when there's much more, there's self-driving cars or other things where we, our attention is freed up more a bit. Like, does that mean podcasts will fall by the wayside or they will move into motion in a different way? So yeah, there's lots of interesting questions that this opens up.
I think I agree. I agree half with you, half with the article, and that, like, I don't want it to become mainstream because of all the things. Well, not don't want it to become mainstream. That's such a fucking hipster thing to say. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want it to become, you know, network podcasting, you know, more so than it already is because of all the things that we've discussed that are so beautiful about the podcast medium, that it is this direct line to a niche audience, that anyone can do it. That's a beautiful thing about it. But I get frustrated that I have friends, and I'm not talking about like my 80-year-old grandma. Like, I have friends my age who like just can't really figure it out because it is confusing and there's so many different apps and a lot of them are crap and it's confusing. And I hate that sometimes I can't like share shows with them or they can't get into it because it's, there's such this weird barrier to entry. My mom can only figure out how to listen to our show and that's it.
Well, I think there's a lot of interesting new platforms that are coming out that are answering these questions in different ways. I know Anchor is one of them and whether or not they'll succeed, I think is another question. But yeah, like there's always going to be this period of like, well, what Anchor's trying to do is be like the Instagram for audio, you know, that people, that podcasts aren't these hour long or half hour long things, but, you know, rather these more kind of stream of consciousness things and people capturing content in kind of smaller ways and distributing like Instagram.
That's awful.
But even like Instagram, you know, there is this kind of take up period where it's just like, you know, something all of a sudden is nothing. And then it just has this, you know, the factors are right there. So look, I think it's great that we're asking these questions. I think this is a great piece. And I think if you're listening to this podcast, you like podcasts.
Like, subscribe, rate.
Like, subscribe, everything. But look, yes, speaking of which, going back to our obligatory script to wrap up, we will put this link and everything else on our show notes, which you can find every week at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. And I think that'll do us for our links for this week. It is time for, drumroll please, the brilliantly named by me, of course, thumbs up / thumbs down, the time we dedicate each week to get the good, the bad, and the completely petty off our chest. Why? Because nobody else will listen to us. Laura, get us started. What do you got, a thumbs up or a thumbs down this week?
Do I have a thumbs down? So yeah, look, last night, Clara and I were attempting to connect a laptop to a client's projector. Should be simple stuff. We wanted to use Clara's MacBook because she had all the content that we needed open already. But because her MacBook is a newer model, it doesn't fit with any of the standard HDMI adapters that all our clients seem to have. So, you know, no worries. We'll use my laptop. My laptop, being an older model, works just fine with the HDMI adapter. However, the only charger we had was for the newer model MacBook, which of course doesn't work with my older model MacBook. And then we also needed to tether internet from our phones because the Wi-Fi wasn't working. But of course, both our iPhones have Xi iPhone batteries that were very nearly dead. And we came prepared, of course, with a charging cable, but we didn't want to plug it into my computer given that it wasn't on a charge itself. And we didn't want to like risk draining more of its battery while it was plugged into the projector. But of course, we can't use the charging cable with Clara's MacBook because new MacBooks don't have USB ports. And then today I'm having to record the podcast just like directly into the MacBook inbuilt mic because my stupid newer Apple headphones have a lightning connection. And of course, my MacBook only has the regular 3.5mm jack. So anyway, my thumbs down today is just to Apple's like insane determination to constantly change their connections and ruin any chance I could possibly ever have in life of just like easily connecting things.
Laura, you don't appreciate the brave decision-making that went into that. So.
Oh my God, fuck off. Like, I can't. It makes me so mad. Someone else.
Bianca, what do you got? Thumbs up or thumbs down?
I just, on that, I'm actually at the point where AirPods seem desirable.
AirPods are amazing.
It's so many, like, there's like, it's gotten to the point where enough people are wearing them where I was like, yeah, I could wear that. That would look pretty cool.
There was an amazing parody when they first came out about somebody using like those toothbrush tops, like, like, and just putting them in their ears.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's good. Okay, woe is me. I live in New York City, best place in the world. It is a nightmare to move here. I actually, the real estate market to start with is the most stressful. Like, probably San Francisco is like the only other place in the world which is as stressful as trying to find an apartment in New York City. And then actually the physical like anything to do with doing anything physical in this city. I just cannot. I have a real thumbs down right now for New York City.
Burn.
Yeah. Bring us back up, please.
This is actually a link and it's a bit of a thumbs up and thumbs down. I don't know. Maybe it's kind of like a waving thumb. I mean, it's hilarious, but it's an article on Vice about a man who fell into Anish Kapoor's work in Portugal. Have you guys heard about this?
No, but what? That sounds incredible.
So Anish Kapoor, the kind of sculptor artist, he has this piece of art, which is called Descent into Limbo. And it's a hole around like 2.5 meters deep in the middle of a gallery. Oh. And the hole is painted black. And it's, I don't know, maybe like a meter and a half wide as well. And so from where you are, it just looks like a black circle on the ground because it's completely circular and completely black. It just looks flat. But it actually is a hole. And apparently a 60-year-old Italian man fell into it. I feel so bad for laughing at it.
Oh, no.
But I don't know. It's like he had, I guess you could say he had a real encounter with the art, if that's not.
Is he okay? Like, am I allowed to laugh at him? Like, is he fine?
You're allowed to laugh. Apparently, you know, he was hospitalized, but the museum spokesperson told ArtNet News he'd already left the hospital and is recovering well.
Well, people have fallen into those Terrell pieces.
Oh, yeah.
Well, apparently there were barriers around it. I don't know. This is kind of like my worst nightmare about accidentally falling into something.
Do you remember when that kid tripped and like punched that painting?
No.
You remember this?
No.
This kid he was in a museum in Taiwan and he tripped and he punched a $1.5 million painting. Like he put his arm out to stop himself and he put his fist through a $1.5 million painting.
No, I have not heard of that, but it's very interesting. And it's also an apt metaphor for what we try to do every day in our own way here at Jackie Winter. And with that, I think we'll end. Thank you so much, Bianca, for joining us this week.
Hey, thank you,
Laura.
You guys.
Good luck today in Sydney.
Thank you.
I'm Jeremy Wartzman, she's Laura Chan-Baker, she's Bianca Bramham, and this has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Our theme music is by, totally unrelated to our company, Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. If you want more of the podcast, archives of all of our shows and the links we covered here can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. And to receive all the links we talk about every week, you can sign up to our podcast-specific newsletter at tinyletter.com/Jackie Winter. If you want more Jackie Winter, you can find us mostly on Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And you can hit us up with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@JackieWinter.com. Every email we get helps us reach another one of the 52,000 missing podcast listeners somewhere in the world.
52 million.
If you love what you hear, you can really help us out by subscribing, rating us, and not subscribing, but maybe leave us a comment on iTunes, and of course, recommend us to all your mites, as well as iTunes. They can get the show wherever you get your podcasts, including Spotify and Stitcher, or directly from our website, which again is JackieWinter.givesyouthe.biz. Remember that this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this using Pocket Cast, Overcast, or Castro, you'll be able to see links to the articles as we're talking about them, as well as other schmick visual content as we rabbit on. And if you work for an ad agency or design studio and are interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out opentabs.rodeo for more info. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye, bye, bye. Robot hands and human hands could be interesting, though, like in terms of how,
yeah.
You know, that could, like, how will that...
The artists could work, yeah.
Really?
I'd love some fucking robot hands, totally.